From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robert Hughes has been a guest on this show a number of times in his various roles as art critic, biographer, historian, polemicist, and television commentator. But today he's here to talk about himself. He's written a memoir about his life from his early years growing up in Australia to his start as the art critic for Time magazine, a position he held for over 30 years. Things I Didn't Know is published by Knopf, and as always, I am pleased to welcome Robert Hughes to my show.
Hello. And I'm pleased to be back on it.
You opened the book with the near-fatal car accident. And can you tell us a bit about that? The last time you were here, I think, to talk about Goya, you had already been through the accident.
That's right.
But we were too busy talking about Goya, who's back in town.
Well, Goya is much more interesting than any car accident, I got to say, even mine. The book opens with that because I wanted it to sort of open, as it were, with a bang.
I thought it's because your life flashed before you.
No, my life didn't flash before me, strangely enough. What, however, did flash before me when I was, during those months of post-operative recovery and during the dreams in the coma too, was the necessity, which seemed imperative to me, to sort of get my life in order. And the only way that I could get my life in order was by writing about it, you know.
Well, you almost died, didn't
I almost
you?
Died.
And you'll never be fully recovered?
Let us never say never, but certainly I've had a bad leg ever since. I mean, the thing is that every bone just about on the right-hand side of my body was broken. Mm. Ribs and sternum and five fractures in the right leg and blah, blah, blah. It's a tedious and unpleasant catalogue. As a result of that, I think I did get certain insights, into the contingent nature of human life. It had never really occurred to me before that I was going to die, you know. It's something that, I'm now 68, so this happened when I was just past 60. You know, and some of us retain a certain obtuseness until quite late in life. I didn't put the prospect of death together with the fact of life. Well, the accident, I guess, enabled me to do so, so that was something of a plus.
It's interesting, as an art historian, you probably looked at a fair number of paintings in which people hypothesized about what would happen after you died.
Indeed, I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of paintings of the afterlife, of heaven and hell and limbo and purgatory and of people inflicting horrendous tortures upon other people and victims are quite eminent, like God being crucified, and others are quite lowly, like wretched sodomites being turned on the grill in hell. But you see, none of this really gets through to you. It should have. I mean, it doesn't get through to you in its true quality. It probably should have, because I was raised a Catholic, you know, as I dare say you were too. Lopate?
No, Italian? I wasn't. But I've spoken to a fair number of Jesuits, and you went to Jesuit boarding school. I have some sense of what you went through, both positive and negative.
Yeah, I mean, you are given this very, very formidable stock of imagery in terms of which to think about death. But the trouble is that in my limited experience, there isn't anything on the other side.
But the Jesuits can be incredibly intellectual. On the other hand,
they can be very intelligent.
They give you a hard time because you were reading James Joyce.
Well, the two don't necessarily contradict one another. I mean, Torquemada, the celebrated Spanish inquisitor, I'm told, was a man who would have qualified for Mensa. Don't forget, we're talking about the early 50s. We're talking about a time when the Catholic Church and its instruments, including the Jesuits, were much more dogmatic than they tend to be now, or at any rate than they come on as now. And so therefore and when that idea of the index, the forbidden books, was still a practical reality.
You were in a Jesuit boarding school because your father wanted you to be there?
Because my father and my family wanted me to be there. It was a family tradition. My father had been educated at St. Ignatius, so had my brothers, and so on.
You say in the book that you now realize much of your life has been in rebellion against your father.
I think that's inevitable. Well, I think in rebellion against the environment of piety and dogmatism which surrounded him.
But he was also a war hero, wasn't he?
He very, very much was. I mean, I have to say he was a man I tremendously admired, and I think the book definitely reflects that. I think the book makes that clear. But there are certain people, however admirable, whose footsteps you cannot necessarily follow in.
In fact, you seem to have decided to go in as totally opposite footsteps as you
can. I wouldn't
say
the
But he also died when you were 12, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right.
You had a rather truncated relationship.
I didn't really know him. I didn't know him as an adult, which is the only way that you can really know somebody.
Now, you don't spend much time on the details of your personal life, the marriages, your son's suicide, etc. But as your title suggests, this is mostly the story of your education.
It is. And don't forget, there is a second volume to come. I mean, at the time that the first volume, Things I Didn't Know, at the time that finishes, I'm just on the point of leaving for America. And my son, who was later to commit suicide, was only 2. So, it's not as though I'm avoiding the question of his unhappy suicide. It's that comes as something to write about later.
The way the title is presented on the cover is it's Things I Know with a stamp over it that says didn't. Is that the way you conceived of this book, or is that an art director's cleverness?
The way I conceived of the book was not... I mean, it was related to that, but basically what the book confronts is the fact that very often we don't know stuff that we know somehow has affected us. And the only way to get to know it is to write about it, to bring out of the oubliette things that you didn't know.
Well, here you are, someone who spent much of your life thinking about art. When did that start?
It started quite young. You see, the thing is that certainly at school there was no art training.
But there was religious art, because
there was religious art,
but the kind of
religious art that you saw at St. Ignatius College was terrible garbage. You know, it was sort of plaster piosities of a low order, smirking pale blue virgins and so forth. I don't think I saw what I would now remember as a great religious picture until after I left Australia. Reproduction is a different matter, of course.
But you've said that actually cartoons in the magazine Punch were an early inspiration.
Everything visual was an early effect, had some sort of early effect. I was very lucky in that although I would not describe my family as having been one particularly given to the visual arts, nevertheless, they were. My father's library was good, and it had an enormous number of books in, and some were illustrated books. And it was from these illustrated books that I got some idea.
Now, you're growing up in Australia, which generally could be described as provincial, at least in terms of the arts at that time.
Well,
but there was a famous artist who was coming, Sidney Nolan, who was changing people's ideas in Australia about modern art.
Yeah, well, Sid Nolan wasn't the only one. And in fact, the idea that Australia was some kind of aesthetic desert was not true, certainly not at the time that I was growing up. I mean, there were some really good Australian artists, Nolan, but others too. And although there were no really significant old master collections, nevertheless, there was good stuff that you could see in the museums. I mean, a number of people reviewing the book have said, oh, poor young Robert growing up in this backwater. Well, it wasn't it was a backwater and it wasn't. I mean, the idea that it was in some way devoid of significant and interesting things to look at is really not true.
You still say that an important moment in your life was when you saw Duccio's Maiesta Siena.
Transcendently important.
Why that of all of the great art in Italy? Not that the Maiesta isn't one of the greatest masterpieces of all time.
Well, I suppose I could frivolously say you have to start somewhere. But the first great work that really reached into me, that struck a profound, deep, intense emotional chord, something which I cannot really explain in any full sense, was that great Trecento painting in Siena. I was living in Italy. I used to go all over the place on my in my little Fiat or on my little Lambretta. But I would always, when I could, make a point of visiting Siena for two principal things. I must stress that these were not the only things that I loved in Siena, but the two principal things were the Duccio Maiesta, which is, I think, certainly the greatest of all gold ground 13th century paintings in Italy, which is in the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo in Siena, and also another work associated with the cathedral, which are those tremendous sculptures of Pisanos, which originally were on the facade of the cathedral and then were taken down and put in. And going over those sculptures, which I was lucky enough to do with somebody who really understood marble carving, namely, believe it or not, the late Henry Moore, was an absolute revelation to me of what stone could do and be.
But it's interesting that you were attracted to the early Renaissance and the pre-Renaissance in those artists, people who leading up, Pisano's leading up to the Renaissance, and Duccio, an early Renaissance painter, even though at some point you attempted a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, which is...
Well, that came rather later.
He's a polar opposite.
That failure came later. I attempted a biography of Leonardo, and I didn't succeed in writing it. I've still got fragments drifting around. I think, you know, where I was so lucky was that I was able to live in Italy and look at the real things rather than looking at reproductions. It's a great mistake to suppose that you can form an idea of past art or any art that's remote from you or even any art that's close to you from reproduction alone. You have to, as it were, touch the flesh.
And then you went to London and arrived in the swinging 60s.
Well, yeah, they weren't swinging yet, but still.
Were you already working as an art critic?
I was writing about art. I didn't have a formal job as an art critic. The first real job I had was the one that Time gave me in 1970.
So how did you survive all those years?
Freelancing, same as anybody else.
And then Time gave you a job. Now, there we're talking about a mass market magazine hiring somebody to write serious art criticism.
That's right. They did. In those days, they did. I mean, I was extraordinarily lucky that I happened to, I mean, my career path, as they say, happened to intersect with that of a great editor, Henry Grunewald, now alas dead, who was really anxious to up the IQ level of the magazine. And so anyway, he was shown by the books editor a book which I'd written called Heaven and Hell in Western Art. And he thought, you know, this guy's pretty smart. Why don't we see about getting him to write criticism for us?
But
and
you've called yourself completely an elitist when you're writing about cultural matters.
I am completely an elitist.
Which
doesn't mean that I hate pop music. It doesn't mean that I hate popular art.
But it does.
Like that.
It does mean that a mass market magazine isn't necessarily the ideal place.
Well, not now, I guess. I mean, you wouldn't want to get a job as the cultural editor for People magazine. But in those days, it certainly was not generally held that intelligent people couldn't work for mass market magazines.
But you also represented a kind of, I don't know what word to use, conservative view of art. You were generally critical of the cutting edge, the latest hot thing in art?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the cutting edge. I mean, I you know, the cutting edge is a term that I never, ever use. I mean,
Well, I don't want to say avant-garde.
That's exactly. Why don't you want to say avant-garde? Because nobody wants to say
avant-garde.
Because
I think the avant-garde died at a certain point.
It sure did. And indeed, I wrote an essay about this in Time back in 1972, arguing this very point, from which stems the reputation that I have as being anti-modern. Of course, nothing of the kind is true.
Well, I mean, you did go after Julian Schnabel.
I don't think he's a great representative of...
He wound up having a nice career making movies after you kind of hurt him. People never really thought that an art critic could affect a career, but you did affect his career.
I don't know that I did. You know, art critics don't have very much effect. They certainly don't have any power. You know, the people who have power in the art world are the money men and women. But the art critics, not so much. I mean, nobody's going to consult an art critic before they go and spend some utterly psychotic sum like $150 million on Jackson Pollock.
Well, there is the Emperor's New Clothes aspect to writing criticism.
There is that too. I mean, you are expected to exercise an independent judgment. It's an undoubted fact that a great deal of the stuff that creates market sensations is rubbish.
Although not all of it does. And I am a great admirer of Jackson Pollock's work.
I'm not a great admirer of all of it. I think, you shouldn't allow that $150 million to strike you blind and render you incapable of judgment. There are a lot of bad Pollocks out there.
You've done all sorts of other things. You wrote The Fatal Shore, The History of Australia. Weren't you at the co-anchor of the first 2020 show ever?
God almighty, Lopate, you have a memory like an elephant. I was. I mean, I had that one extraordinary experience of a night doing network television.
And that was with Harold Haynes,
the former editor of Esquire. And that's going to be in the next volume of, as yet untitled, volume of my memoirs. We were the first co-anchors of 2020. And so it may be said that I helped preside over one of the real fiascos of recent American television history.
Well, 2020 was better then, just as Time magazine was better then.
Well, it may have been better then. I don't think it was, though, not with Geraldo Rivera's disquisitions on rabbits and so forth. But it was a comic moment for me. And I remember feeling after this first program went out, I thought, my God, you know, here I'm going to be shackled to this dying animal, you know, this ghastly mound of kitsch. And what did you let yourself in for, Hughes? And then to my infinite relief, the following morning, the news came that the television station, ABC, had canned both me and Hayes. And I danced a jig with relief.
So the next book is coming out how soon?
Oh, I don't know. It'll be written how soon. I expect...
You're already at work at it.
Yeah, I am, but I haven't been at work on it for a little while. I've been in Australia.
And you can't write in Australia?
No, it's just they're leading me around like a bear on a string, you know, promoting things I didn't know.
Meanwhile, the really wonderful to read first volume of Robert Hughes' memoir, Things I Didn't Know, is available from Knopf. It is his latest book. He's also written The Culture of Complaint, Barcelona, Nothing If Not Critical, Heaven and Hell in Western Art, Goya. He has received the Frank Jewett Mather Award, art journalism's most coveted award, 2 times. And I want to thank him so much for being with us again.
Well, I want to thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.